Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on April 1st, 2017. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Magiya Sutta. The Magiya Sutta teaches the five qualities to develop to remain focused on the Dhamma. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace. So this morning's talk is on the Magiya Sutta, which is just another practical teaching on the Buddha and how to incorporate five specific qualities as part of a Dhamma practice, as a path to awakening. And I'll read from the Sutta. In the Magiya Sutta, the Buddha teaches Magiya five qualities that bring awakening or full human maturity. Magiya, having taken refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Buddha Sangha, and living as a monk for a reasonable amount of time, finds himself still troubled by three unwholesome qualities of mind. In seclusion, the thought arises in Magiya, "It is indeed strange and remarkable. I have gone forth from home to homelessness," meaning he's left the world behind and joined the Buddha Sangha, "and have been developing the Dhamma. Yet I continue to be overwhelmed by three troubling kinds of thoughts: sensual thoughts, malevolent thoughts, and cruel thoughts." Magiya seeks out the Buddha one afternoon. "Revered teacher, I continue to be troubled by sensual thoughts, by malevolent thoughts, and by cruel thoughts." The Buddha responds, "Magiya, when your mindfulness is not fully refined, still immature, there are five qualities that develop full maturity and the cessation of troubling qualities of mind." So the Buddha is now fine-tuning Magiya's practice. "The first quality to develop are skillful and honorable friends and associations. Avoid unskillful, distracting, and troubling associations." That's a theme that runs throughout all of the Buddha's teachings. He taught to develop the wisdom of choosing our associations wisely, because in a very true extent, what and who we associate with, we're going to become. That's going to determine our life experience. And I'm not talking just about friends now. In general, that's another teaching, another word for clinging is associations. Whatever we associate ourselves with, whether it's through thought, word, or deed, that is going to determine what we experience in our life. And it shouldn't be seen as like a cosmic universal law. It's just a practical teaching. We can't help but separate ourselves from what we associate with. I'm going to read that again. "The first quality to develop are skillful and honorable friends and associations. Avoid unskillful, distracting, and troubling associations." Excuse me. "The second quality to develop is restraint and conduct, avoiding the danger in even the slightest transgressions." So again, the Buddha is pointing this out to someone who is developing the Dhamma, but it's an important teaching for all of us, and we're all developing the Dhamma. Even the slightest transgressions. When we find ourselves straying off the Eightfold Path and maybe making an excuse for it, we talked about this last week in the I can't remember the name of the sutta, where the monk is making excuses for his Dhamma practice by avoiding everything in the Eightfold Path by saying, "I'm a human being, and simply because I'm a human being, this should be okay." Do you remember the name of the sutta?
No, I remember he wanted to do what made him feel good.
Yeah, and that was just, because it makes me feel good, that should mean that it's okay, and the Buddha's wrong by saying those things. Again, this is a theme that the Buddha continually refers back to, even the slightest transgressions. It doesn't mean we should be so rigid in our behavior that we can't even live in the world, but we should recognize the things that are taking us off the path and continuing our own confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering. Again, it's not so much a moral judgment. It's not like if you don't follow these commandments, you're going to burn in hell. It's if you don't stay on the path, you're going to create suffering for yourself and others. "Train yourself to keep all the precepts and to practice right speech, right action, and right livelihood. The third quality to develop is speech that is effacing and does not promote the ego self. Effacing speech relaxes the mind and conduces toward dispassion, peace, direct knowledge, unbinding, enlightenment, in a word, to Nibbana, or Buddhist, the meaning awakening. We put out the fires of passion and we've now awakened. That's what Nibbana means. That self-effacing, if you can, I think we can all relate to the idea. If I'm so concerned about being the greatest Buddhist teacher and you notice that I'm the greatest Buddhist teacher, I'm not going to be a very good teacher, am I? Because my thoughts are going to be caught up in those self-referential views rather than being present with the Dhamma. And we've all had that experience where we're involved with someone and we feel like we need to state our case. We're likely not going to be very self-effacing in that type of situation, are we? Because we're going to be too concerned about establishing ourselves, establishing an ego self. So engage in speech. It's interesting that the Buddha, I've read a lot of the Pali Canon, maybe 85%. You know, I really don't know, but it's a lot of it. And nowhere does a Buddha refer to himself as a Buddha, meaning an awakened one, in a self-referential way. He always referred to himself as the Tathagata, which meant the one who first went forth, the guy who figured this out first. And then he's just teaching for the rest of his life. And there's many stories where the Buddha could have established himself in the social order, meaning that a local leader wanted to claim the Buddha as his own, meaning, you know, this guy is part of my kingdom, and the Buddha always turned that down. He never took any type of award. He never attached any type of appellation to his name. He was simply this guy that figured it out consistently, always self-effacing. Even when he was referring to himself as an example, he showed himself as a human being developing this. He never put himself up as someone having superhuman powers that I was able to achieve this. Because if you think about what the Buddha taught, that would separate himself from everyone else, wouldn't it? And put himself up into a position to be worshipped, which is what he deeply understood that. What he was so careful about teaching is that I'm just a human being like everyone else. And if I can do it, you can do it. He taught a Dhamma for all human beings to develop. The fourth quality to develop is energy and right effort for abandoning unwholesome qualities and developing wholesome qualities of mind. Be vigorous and persevering with regard to wholesome qualities, meaning we need to engage in the Dhamma and understand the qualities that we are to develop. The fifth quality to develop is wisdom born of penetrative knowledge of the arising and passing away of suffering, knowledge with regard to the Four Noble Truths. That's referring to a deep and penetrating understanding of the impermanence of all things. And most importantly, an impermanence of our self-referential views. Excuse me. When mindfulness is still unrefined and immature, these are the five qualities to be developed that lead directly to full maturity, to awakening. It is expected, Magia, that one who has skillful friends and associates, that they will be restrained in conduct and follow the precepts. In other words, if we're hanging around with a gang of Hell's Angels, we're not likely to be well focused on the Dhamma. But if we're hanging around and spending our time in association with people that are well focused on the Dhamma, meaning this Sangha, and at other times we remain mindful of the Eightfold Path, we're inclining our minds towards awakening. But if a great deal of our time is spent in associations with people that aren't so well inclined, and we're doing things as part of that group, even if it's a so-called Buddhist practice which isn't well focused, we're hindering our own development. We're hindering our own awakening. One who has skillful friends and associates will be effacing in speech, conducing their mind towards direct knowledge and unbinding. One who has skillful friends will have the energy and effort to abandon unwholesome qualities and develop wholesome qualities. One who has skillful friends will be wise, born of penetrative knowledge of the arising and passing away of suffering, knowledge with regard to the Four Noble Truths. Furthermore, Magia, one who has established these five qualities should develop four additional qualities. Uh-oh, more to do. Sensual craving should be abandoned. Now he's really getting to the heart of the matter. But he's also referring right back to the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. Metta, goodwill or loving kindness, should be cultivated. And we do that as part of our normal practice, don't we? Mindfulness of the breath should be maintained to interrupt discursive and conditioned thinking. So the Buddha is not just talking about our meditation practice now, isn't he? He's talking about off our cushion. When we find ourselves getting caught up in the world, we can use the breath to keep ourselves well-focused and maintain our refined mindfulness. Come back to the sensation of breathing. Impermanence should be fully understood to cease eye-making and understand not self. And now the Buddha is referring to the three marks of existence. When the interplay between impermanence and not self, eye-making, is abandoned and suffering ends, this is nibbana here and now. When we recognize in any situation, when we're, this goes back to self-effacing speech, when we're involved in the world in a way that we're promoting self-referential views, this sense of self, this sense of a permanent self, and protecting these views, we're creating more confusion, delusion, and suffering for ourselves. When we recognize that at any point in time, this thing that we call a self is as impermanent as all other things in the phenomenal world, what is there to preserve and protect? There's nothing here. There's nothing here substantial. It's not to say that there's no such thing as a self. But if we're promoting a sense of self in this moment, that sense of self is either rooted in a past conditioning or it's stuck in a projection of what we hope to be in the future, and we're missing our life right now. That's why dukkha arises from that situation. Again, last week we were talking, wish I could think of the name of that sutta, we were talking about how self-referential views are always keeping us stuck in the past or pushing us forward, and we're never here in our moment-by-moment life. That's what true mindfulness means. It means to hold in mind the framework of the Eightfold Path so we can be present with our life as our life unfolds and live a truly meaningful life, free of the distractions of promoting an ego-based self. Is that clear? Is it clear how what the Buddha is teaching to Maggia is exactly for that purpose, so that he can recognize and abandon self-referential views? Of course, that's the whole goal of the Dhamma, isn't it? And these are the five qualities to develop. The Buddha concludes the sutta with verse. Trivial thoughts, subtle thoughts, mental reactions that continue to distract, not understanding conditioned thinking, one wanders endlessly in samsara, or ignorance. It's another word, ongoing dukkha, is samsara. Understanding the roots of ignorance, the ardent and mindful restrains ignorance. The fully awakened completely abandons ignorance and the mental reactions that continue to distract. Again, the mental reactions, a distracted mind, a mind that is agitated is an unawakened mind. A mind that is awakened is a mind of equanimity, a mind that is continually resting in peace and happiness because it understands what's occurring. When you truly understand what's occurring, there's no stress, is there? Because there's full acceptance of it. Again, as we develop the Dhamma, we understand the difference between approval and acceptance. An awakened mind, and I would say even an awakening mind, a mind that is inclined towards awakening, is a mind that is at peace because it understands. Understands what? Understands everything. Understands that life in the phenomenal world is prone to dukkha. If I can keep myself out of it, I can remain at peace. That's really the entire Dhamma. And these practical qualities that the Buddha's teaching Maggia are useful for each and every one of us to develop. There's more to the sutta. That's about three quarters of it if you want to finish it. But I've covered what I wrote to in the sutta. So any direct questions on this sutta? Then we'll go around the room. No, you all got it? Good. I mean, there's simple teachings, too. The key is to develop this and integrate these as part of our Dhamma practice. So.
It's kind of disconcerting and kind of satisfying that somebody that he had left his home and was in the full effect of practice, and yet he still had those struggles. So bad.
Yeah, Maggia was deeply what's the word? Boy, I can't talk today. Committed. Was deeply committed to his Dhamma practice, and yet his conditioned mind was still interfering with that practice. And he was fortunate that he had the Buddha to question, which is what the Buddha continually said. If you got a question or a problem, question me directly. we are nearly as fortunate in that we have the written record of what the Buddha taught. We have that simple teaching that he gave Maggia 2,600 years ago, and that teaching is still here today. When I think about that, that's one of the most remarkable things in my life, and I think one of the most fortunate things for all of us. We can still hear these words and take them to heart and understand it. We can apply it to our Dhamma practice in the right way, like you just said. We can realize that I don't quite have it yet, and that's okay. Maggia didn't have it yet. But he used the right questions, too. In one of these classes, the Buddha taught how to, there's four specific ways to answer questions, and I've been wanting to give a teaching on that. And I will one of these days, but it won't be this week. But just a very practical answer. If Maggia was like Vachagoda and said, I'm really troubled by these thoughts, is the universe finite or infinite? What happens to the soul after the body? What happened? The Buddha would either just sat there quietly, showing that those questions don't deserve an answer, that they're rooted in ignorance, or he would say, those questions are rooted in ignorance. They don't deserve an answer. Your questions are confusing you. But a question that relates to the Dhamma, the Buddha answers directly and very usefully too, I think. So thank you for bringing that up, Eva. Anthony, good to see you this morning. How's your Dhamma practice going?
Good. Very good, thanks. enjoyed the sutta. I haven't heard before any of the Buddha's words about associations, but it makes a lot of sense to me. And it's something that I've always thought about, you know, that your associations are very important, because they do move you in a direction that you might not want to be in. It's interesting, I think, that sometimes we can get drifted away in these thoughts about the past and the future. And I was caught up in a particularly negative state that was causing me some pain. It was like a sort of a past experience that sort of bubbled up.
Yeah.
And one of the ways that I found to get out of it, which I would share with everybody, was kind of interesting. I was almost started to become a game. Every time I had a thought, like I would just label it and say, oh, that's a past thought. Oh, that's a future thought. Oh, that's a negative thought.
That's great.
You know, oh, that's desire's thought. And when I did that and detached it from me, it continued to bring me into the present.
Wow.
And then I started to just get more into the present and just look at it as sort of a game, you know.
That's great. You're directly recognizing the I making in these things.
And then you start to think, wow, my mind really is going all over the place, but it doesn't stay there because you've detached from it, and you don't get pulled away with it because you're looking for that to happen.
Yep. That's the essence
of
developing
concentration. It's sort of like meditating while you're living.
Yeah. You are. You know, you're taking what you've developed on your cushion, off your cushion, and applying it into your life.
And so it got me out of that. Like, all of a sudden, it just went away, and I was good after that.
Yeah.
Because every time it bubbled up, I go, oh, that's a past thought again.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Thank you for sharing it. It's just a practical application of concentration and refined mindfulness. And knowing how to label something is the most important aspect of that. And seeing things clearly and seeing the eye making in it. So that's great. Thank you, Anthony.
Yeah, thanks. Because sometimes I think we want to fight with it and try to rationalize it.
Yep.
And sometimes it's better not to just recognize it's there and label it and let it go.
That's it. It's always better. You know, whether we're we just want to mess around with it, or sometimes we get into deep analysis. Where did this come from? Why am I thinking of this? And recognize it as eye making and let it go. That's all we need to do. The rest of it then becomes its own distraction. There's even so-called meditation techniques that are taught that you bring up a subject and you deeply analyze it and get into the roots of it. That's not meditation.
Yeah, because it can lead you down a rabbit hole sometimes.
Oh, it almost always will, especially when you're lacking the framework of how to see things clearly. It's so important. The Buddha never taught anything like that, to use meditation for analysis or any of that. There are some suttas that people will cite, like the meditation on the charnel grounds, where the Buddha talks about recognizing how a body breaks down, and that the internal properties of a body are basically disgusting. It's full of pus and blood, blah blah blah, and that's important to recognize. That's just part of being a human being. We should recognize that the body is not the most beautiful thing in the world. that there's some qualities that are unpleasant, just to recognize that. And there's entire Buddhist practices that are Buddhist meditation practices that get into minute detail about what the Buddha was simply teaching, to just recognize this. You know, don't be so enamored with the body. Take a good look at it and then realize it.
In the context of impermanence, right?
In the context of impermanence, that's right.
It's missing from that other.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a rather famous meditation practice, to get into that. And then I'll get on to another subject. But yeah, meditation is taught primarily to deepen concentration, not for analysis, not for any other reason, so that off your cushion you have that concentration where you can recognize where you're falling out of the path, seeing things clearly. Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you.
Kevin, good to see you this morning.
Good to see you. I like Anthony's sort of, analogy of that, the sort of mental volley that we have, you know, it's like deflecting the second arrow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Matt and I actually were talking about this, about the mind and how meditation, you know, it's something that over time keeps the mind, I think, taught. You know, like, you know, over time we age, and, you know, we were thinking, you know, how far does that get out there, you know, the neuroplasticity and all that. But I like it. The Sutta was really, really, you know, direct for me. The last one last week, about sort of the auspicious day, they sort of seem to intertwine. That,
yeah.
You know, we have the ability in each moment, you know, and then it sort of points me towards what we're building to with this Sunday, next Sunday, and then in the spring. It's each moment there's an opportunity for emptying, you know, emptying ourselves of these views, and that's really profound. And there's just more layers to it that I'm starting to see every moment, you know. This Sutta, particularly the associations, I mean, I think more, you know, especially in the context of my life where it is now, it's sort of professional associations. You know, who am I associating with professionally? Where is that leading me? Is it leading me to distraction, or is it leading me towards awakening? And I've really been taking sort of stock, you know, no pun intended, I'm in the financial business, of who I'm associating with. And, you know, it's really refreshing to hear a couple of other people, I may have a couple of years on them, but saying the same thing, that they're just like, I want to get out of this business in the next 5 years. This isn't doing it for me. And I'm not, you know, doing the whole, oh, the vibration's lifting, because we all know that's kind of a farce, you know, with what we learn here. But it's very encouraging for me to hear that others, you know, in their own sense, are coming to some understanding that this is just, what's this for? What's this thing for? What's this for? And I've noticed that with my associations very clearly. So really appreciate the talk. And I realized in some stressful situations with those associations that it's just happening. It's just here. It's not it's impermanent. This is just, I'm not defined. This is not me. This is not mine. This is not who I am. This is not myself. This is not, you know, this group or whatever. You know, it's really neat. And during some stressful stuff, it's just so profound and helpful. So thank you so much for teaching it in this sequence and for everybody else in the saga.
Thank you for being here and saying that. The ultimately, it's association and entanglement with the world that we need to recognize and let go of. That's the idea of going forth. There's an article on the website, and I've given a few talks on what that means. When the Buddha left the kingdom and went in search of understanding, that's called going forth. And there's a symbolic application of that, and just the simple practical application of, he realized that there was no way that he could develop understanding living in the luxury as a prince in his father's kingdom. But he also recognized that that would be the same whether he took a job as the local chariot driver. He needed to be removed from the world, to be disentangled from the world, to not be associating with the world in order to develop his awakening. And that was something that was rather common during the Buddha's time, and it still is. There were many people that at a certain age would leave whatever they were doing, whether they had a home life, and they would spend some time developing some spiritual understanding. But that whole idea of disassociating with the world is so important to develop a Dhamma practice. And that's what, for those of us that are still, excuse me, involved in the world, we can still take refuge in the Dhamma, can't we? Mm-hmm. And we can take refuge in the Sangha, meaning, so I'm talking about the Ratana Sutta. And we do take refuge every time we engage in a well-focused Dhamma practice, we're taking refuge in the Buddha, in the fact that a human being did just this and he awakened. And in that way, we are removing ourselves from the world enough, quantitatively enough, or qualitatively enough, in order to awaken. We're not fully immersed in the world. We're not completely entangled in the world. That's the true meaning of refuge for those of us that aren't leaving the world completely behind, which is the great majority of Buddhist practitioners today, isn't it? You know? And it was even true at the Buddhist time. That many people that awakened through direct interaction with the Buddha were not monks and nuns in his sangha. Most of them were at the time. But there are still many stories of householders, people not part of the sangha, that awakened. And if it wasn't for those people, there'd be no Buddhist practice today. They wouldn't have been preserved. If it wasn't for Anathapindika, who was a very well-known and prosperous business person who financially supported the Buddha by giving him the monastery that the Buddha used every rainy season for most of his life is Anathapindika's monastery, that landed that was given by the Buddha. And there's many, many stories of kings and other lay people that supported the Buddha in his practice. So we're doing what other people have done. And we don't have to leave the world entirely in order to develop the Buddha's Dhamma, but we need to recognize our entanglements and our attachments and our associations to the world and look at them wisely. So, Tommy, good to see you.
Good morning, everyone. What's the time period that this is occurring?
About 2,600 years ago.
So that's the 13th century?
No. No, it's the... Well, it's... 600 years before the Common Era.
Yeah. I'm trying to put it in perspective. I spent some time in India and referenced the temples in Khajuraho, which are so filled with basically killing and sex.
Yeah.
It's all the depiction. And trying to better get a perspective on where his head was, you know, what was he up against, what was going on around him, you know, that compelled him in all these ways as well.
The Buddha was well aware of all of those things. It was animal and human sacrifice was common during the Buddha's time. Mm-hmm. He was well aware of it. And part of that was attached to the caste system. In other words, if you were one of the, I can't remember what they were called then, but I'll call them the undesirables. If you were the lowest of the low class.
Untouchables.
That's what they're called today, but there was another word back then. Mm-hmm. They were the ones that it was, if you needed to do a human sacrifice, you grabbed one of these poor folks off the street because they don't account to anything. Now you think about, that's the mindset that the Buddha awakened in. And one of the first things he taught is you can't do that. We are all the same. There's no difference between the so-called untouchable and the great Brahmin kings. Almost immediately, they were beginning to have death threats on the Buddha. You can't. That's blasphemous. How can you say that? Of course, he persevered. A short time later, he also talked about we don't kill animals for sacrifice. And think about where that understanding came from. If you have now removed yourself from the idea of a supreme creator God that is going to protect me and bestow me with awakening and gifts and all the rest of the stuff, what are you sacrificing to? Again, an entirely practical Dhamma. I was going to get into something else too, but you're absolutely right. So he grew up in a time that is very similar to ours as far as the competitiveness in society. And even we still have it's not as well defined, but we still have a class system in the world today. And he recognized all of that as saying that's just hurtful and unskillful behavior. Bring yourself to the Dhamma. When you start developing the Dhamma, any idea of human sacrifice or animal sacrifice or any type of that sacrifice or ritual just falls away. So, you bring up a good point. I hope I didn't talk over what you meant to say, though.
Perspective for me. I mean, I'm sort of a newbie, and so I'm trying to put everything in pieces and perspective. Yeah. The meditation for me is that relationship between, you know, the body and the spirit, elevating the spirit, calming the mind. If I can get anywhere near that on a Sunday or a Saturday, this is a good thing.
Yeah, and that's the beginning of developing a complete Dhamma practice. You know, beginning with meditation, and then slowly incorporating as best we can the entire Eightfold Path. That's what the Buddha taught. You know? That's all he ever taught. So, good to see you, Tommy. Eva, good to see you.
Doing hi. You're walking along and you think you're doing fine, and then you stumble, and then you know you should get up, but instead you just go deeper into the thing. And I had a situation where I'm amazed at how everything went out the window, and I just went back to, this is mine, and you can't have it, and I want it, and I know I shouldn't, and I know I, let me try to do this, and let me do this, and let me try, and wow, I just couldn't get out of it, and sort of even created further, I could see how by doing what I did and saying what I said, how others kind of went along with me. And so then we were, you know, a group against this thing. It was a very weird but very shocking experience, because I thought, you know, you keep thinking, wow, you know, I think I've gotten someplace, I can handle this, I'm, you know, I'm cool. And wow, just went right back to it, and created a negative situation. And then it's like, wow, now what do I do, you know? I feel guilty, I feel, you know, I did this, I should have said that, I whatever. It was just so, still not resolved. And, you know, so yeah, okay, so I got to face, you know, I got to, you know, admit that my need to make something that really was not anything at all, really, a very trivial little thing, but it was like, that was the one, the little stone that knocked the whole set of stones down, you know, by just doing that one little thing, it just knocked every, well, it brought back all those memories of things and things that I've been angry about that I, you know, thought I had put in the past and had, you know, better dealing and the perspective of. And it turned out that I didn't, so that's why this particular sutta is like, okay, so, it's not that bad, okay.
Yeah.
But it's just, wow, it's just like, I feel like I'm starting all over again. I've got to clear out all this stuff that's still in there.
Thank you for saying that, but you're not starting over again, or you wouldn't have recognized the Buddha's words. Even the slight, notice the danger in even the slightest transgression. So that little transgression, that little thing, took you all the way down that path. Probably the worst word I could have used there, path, took you all the way down into that deluded view and that unsatisfactory experience, but you recognized it. You recognized what you were doing. That's how the framework of the Eightfold Path works. You know, it's called a path for a lot of reasons. One of them is it's recognized that we might fall off the path, but we can get back on. You know, once we know it, you know, that's that beginning aspect of right view too. You understand now that I have a choice. I'm not just stuck in these behaviors and these views. And that's the framework that you, the refined mindfulness that you use to recognize that you were off it. So, yeah. And that's just the way it is. And look at all the eye-making in there, but you don't recognize when you're that close to it, when you're that entangled with your self-referential views, you can't see them. You can't see the forest for the trees, you know. That's what that's about. But you were able to regain a measure of concentration and refined mindfulness and see it, you know, from the past development of the Dhamma. That's why you're able to see it. That's true mindfulness, too. So good for you. And thank you for sharing that. Because it happens to all of us. Mm-hmm. Becky, good to see you this morning.
Hi, John. Good to see you here. Good to be here. Well, is it Anthony?
Yes.
Anthony. Loved what you said.
Oh, thank you.
I'm still, you know, very, very new to this. And it's still hard for me to use it in my everyday life. And I know I've been saying this week after week and, you know, trying. But I know when it's just nice when I am in right view. And I can recognize when I'm there. And it makes my whole day, sometimes I can be there for a whole day or at least for part of a day, but then very quickly I will deteriorate into my old self. And then it's hard for me to get back. Usually to get back, I have to meditate. I mean, not have to, but you know, if I meditate, I can get back for a little while.
Yeah.
This week, it was really difficult for me to get back at all. I was very angry a lot of the time, and looking around and just eye making everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, I want this to be like this, I don't want this to be like this. And I think if I had Anthony's words, I would have been able to do better. Because just coming back to your breath, that helps. But sometimes when you're in it, you just don't know you're in it. You're just going along.
Yeah.
You know, your old self doing what you do.
Conditioned thinking.
It's so conditioned. It's amazing how conditioned you are. But I have, what helps is to rereading the book, read the suttas that you send out. All of that really helps to keep focused on the path. So all I can say is that, you know, I'm working along, and sometimes it's helping, and sometimes it's good, and sometimes it's just, you know, not.
Dukkha occurs.
Yeah, dukkha occurs, right.
What's significant, though, Becky, is that you said that when you're in right view, you have wonderful days. It's
yeah.
So important to
and
recognize that.
It's the same kind of day. Nothing different happens. You know, nothing different happens. It's not like I win the lottery on those days. You know,
but the quality
I mean?
Of your mind is at peace.
The quality of,
yeah.
Auspicious day.
It's an auspicious
day.
Bhatta Karada Sutta.
Auspicious day, yes.
Yeah. The Buddha continually said ehipasiko, meaning come and see for yourself, meaning you have to have the experience of it. It's not enough to just listen
yes.
to what he's saying or read the Dhamma. You have to have the experience of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the experience
yes,
of it.
Experience of it.
And having had that auspicious day, that right view day, you know that it's there for you. You know that you can continue to develop it.
Right. And, you know, like missing last week here, I think that's one of the reasons that I had a difficult week this week.
Oh, I'm sure it is.
Yeah. You really have to be, this really keeps you focused, really keeps you, you know, in the right place.
It's a true refuge
yeah.
from the world, which is, again, that's the Ratana Sutta.
I found listening to the recordings to be the same, you know, the bridge between it. I mean, I was, you know, I had a commute, I still have a commute, I listened to one of the talks, I'll just pick one of the old, you know, I probably have heard them now a bunch of times, but
mm-hmm.
you can hear this talk. Hear these exact words, and it has an effect. It really does. Like in the morning or driving, it might line you up towards those auspicious days. That's all. It's just it really.
Do you
know,
listen to the whole class? Or
I mean,
just
I don't listen to
talk.
The sit. You know, but I'll,
no, of course
yeah,
not.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, and I feel like after if I practice in the morning which I try to do, and then driving, it's just this. You know,
nice.
I really liked what you said the other day, John, in the talk. That the mind doesn't understand, you know, it's just all one day kind of thing. It's all, you know, the linear thing like you
yeah.
said. That
yeah.
that was pretty neat, you know, that every day is auspicious. It should be, you know, it's just not getting caught up along
yeah.
the way.
It's
right. just all one, you know, that I just thought that was pretty neat to think of that context too.
Thank you. You're right. Well, the everything that I teach, nearly everything, is recorded.
Right. Most of the, some of them.
Yeah, most of the talks are on my podcast, and also the ones that are associated with articles are on the website. And now that I've been streaming in class, the YouTube videos are also on my website and on YouTube, so you can listen to them that way too, if you find them helpful. So, yeah. Thanks, Kevin. just to make the point that the Ratana Sutta and how fortunate we are to have a well-focused Sangha. I mean, it's really remarkable what has developed here in Frenchtown, because I've been in the Buddha game for a long, long time, and there's not too many well-focused Sanghas like this that I've come across. And I'm taking some credit for that, but not all of it, because if I'm just sitting here by myself, it's not a well-focused Sangha, is it? You know, it's all of us here that have taken to the Dhamma and developed it in a way that we're able to have a true Sangha and support each other by the things that we say and the things that we share. It really is remarkable. We don't get into a lot of the things that other people get into, such as rites and rituals and chanting, or talking about other practices and other later developed teachers. We stay focused on the Buddha's Dhamma. And we're able to do that. That's a remarkable thing to me. So thank you all for that. Jay, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Thanks. Good to see you. Doing fairly well. This was a pretty easily accessible sutra. Don't hang around with jerky people. Don't be a pervert. Don't walk around pissed off or whatever. Or try and do bad things to people. So it wasn't hard. I guess at this time of year, my mind is on the natural world and in the river. It's going to be shad season. Here I am looking out the window, and there's that river zooming by, high, wide, nasty. The fact that this is cross-river meditation, I like. It's one of the things that attracted me to come over to begin with. It was a good name. Many years ago I would have read Siddhartha, and isn't there a whole part of that where he's involved with Vasudeva, I think it is, the ferryman, and he takes over, he becomes that old ferryman, and I'm not sure if that's just an offshoot that Hermann Hesse put in, or it doesn't seem to have anything connected to the Dharma, the teachings that you've dealt with, so I don't know where he got that, if that was part of the Buddha's life or not, but I guess I like the concept of being by the river, because I live near the river, and it makes a big difference to me. You know, I'm waiting for those shad to come up, and trying to get in the river or watching the river, see what's going on out there. So that's nature is a big preoccupation with me this time of year. We're taking our walks and seeing the wildflowers all of a sudden here. You know, and the snow's melting and stuff's coming up. So that's the stuff I've got my mind on, and I guess that's good, because I'm not spending a lot of time thinking bad thoughts or, whatever. So that's where my mind is. It's out there in the river right now.
Thank you. Yeah, they're just practical teachings. The name Cross River Meditation Center actually came from a student who doesn't come here anymore. Hello, Jan. She listens sometimes, so... and I was teaching here and also up in Riegelsville, so I was on both sides of the river. Mm-hmm. And when I first started, I was talking to her, what to call this? We really should put some kind of name on it. But I didn't want to get some mystical or magical, the flying lotus flowers. and she said, what about Cross River? That's it. She was an artist, too. She made a sign up that was pretty nice. I lost it over the years. But Cross River Meditation Center. And I wrote in a tangential way about this in this article about emptiness that I'll talk about later on today, that the Buddha never called his Sangha anything special either. He wasn't the flying white lotus Sangha. He was just, this was the Sangha. This is the group of monks and nuns and me that we get together and we practice this stuff. And that was important, because if he called it the flying white lotus Sangha, then you're creating an identity. I am part of the flying white lotus Sangha. And a rather nondescript name, and it really is just for direction purposes, Cross River Meditation Center. That's what it is. Rather than creating an identity, and I hope none of you create an identity over over that either, because it's important to recognize this is a place of refuge, but it's not a place to create a new identity over us being a part of this, because that's something else to overcome, isn't it? What happens if we lose our lease? You know, there's a lot of tension there now. Now I can't be a part of that. Everything is impermanent, you know.
Cross River has some nice symbolism to it too, that you're going from confusion and
crossing the river of samsara.
Yeah, you're going to a
big stream,
a better place or a calmer place.
Yeah, that
good symbolism.
That's one of the reasons why I did like it. Crossing the river of samsara, getting to the other shore. You know, so it symbolically it's good, but it's not a name that we can readily create an identity over. At least I hope we can.
So you're not going to be making up T-shirts and sweatshirts.
Wow, there's an idea.
That's the Buddha game.
Yeah, 1595.
Yeah, I got my Dharma. Thank you, Jeff.
That'd be great. Yeah, I could be on billboards.
Yeah. In Flemington.
Call now.
Yep, get your awakening now. Last chance.
Free shipping.
Awakening in 3 installments. All right, we're getting silly. Lisa, it's good to see you this morning.
What a job. That was funny.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry. There's really not that much that makes me laugh anymore. You know, the culture, I'm not sure if I'm going to be saying right or wrong, or if I'm not saying wrong things, but I am delighted to be indoctrinated into this world, that it's there. Even if I don't understand it, I may never. I just, you know, with all my preoccupations and things like that, I may never, you know, get beyond, you know, reading it or trying to understand it, having a really hard time with it, you know, like in a practical sense, but just but just knowing, and the time spent meditating or listening online or reading, you know, computer reading, what you know, things and being here is time well spent. And I'm not doing other things or thinking other things that are not good thoughts.
Yep.
So, I mean, it's just that, even if I don't understand it.
Just that, yep.
I don't know. And also relating to impermanence, I haven't looked what you said about that. You know, the river, it's never the same river. You look out there, it's never the same water. And if you want to look at impermanence, look at nature.
Yep, you can't step in the same river twice.
You know, the water, you know, it's always, everything is always different. And our bodies, too. You know, science has backed up Buddha and everything said about impermanence. You know, our bodies, like our cells, are changing all the time.
Constantly.
You know, every cell in our body is not going to be there. It's going to be other cells coming from who knows where.
Yeah.
You know, so that's impermanence.
Yep. It's an important understanding of impermanence, too.
Mm-hmm. and just, you know, and nature, too.
Yeah.
And time spent. I mean, I think in every tradition, someone's gone off and by themselves on some kind of journey. You know, a journey to learn is like an old story in every culture.
Yep.
Every, you know, but modern life, there's no going off. It's relentless. Our culture's relentless.
Those journeys aren't like what's lost is like the time that they, you know, like the Buddha went for years, you know, like
6 years.
Like, oh, yeah, what if I wanted to just go do that for 6 years? Oh, what's wrong with you? You just left your life. You left this stuff. You don't even get 6 hours anymore. You get 6 days. What are you going to learn in 6 days?
He's still, the Buddha is still looked down on for what he did. how could you leave a wife who had a newborn baby? How could you leave that behind you? Well, it was accepted practice for one thing back then, and I'm sure glad that he did. And eventually his whole family became part of the Sangha. I'm sorry, so you were continuing.
No, that's okay. I'm glad, you know, to have, you know, people's thoughts on it. And, you know, for those working in the corporate work, financial industry, are we having fun yet?
Yeah.
You know, it's just fun. It's so intense.
Yeah.
But, you know, for some people, they're right on it. I mean, you can see them on TV, you know, but it's feeding, I don't know, to me, it's just this. Feeding the wrong thing. It's the complete opposite of let's go off and, you know, think and our minds wander. And that's where the best inventions, the best thoughts have come from, in being alone and people wandering off and thinking.
Yeah.
Even in modern life.
It seems like it's gotten increasingly more intense lately, but then looking back over my life, I would probably say that. But as intense as it gets, as distracting as it gets, as the constant distractions that are there seem to increase, it's still part of the first noble truth, dukkha occurs. And it's in all of that. The way you started what you just said, that you're indoctrinated in the world, I don't know that I would use that word, but perhaps it's an appropriate word. We all are indoctrinated in the world. We can't help that. Again, that refers to the first noble truth. Simply as a consequence of having a human life, this was true 2,600 years ago as it is today, dukkha will occur. That's part of life. And the Buddha didn't teach something as an escape from that. He taught a way for us to end our distraction with ongoing dukkha and to bring to cessation our contributions to our own confusion, delusion, and suffering, which is all that we can do. So we can be a part of the world because we can't help but be a part of the world if we're alive. But we don't have to be distracted by it. We don't have to create additional suffering by needing the world to be any different than it is. And you have a profound understanding of impermanence. No matter what's going on in this world that we're indoctrinated in, remember that it's always impermanent. And the most profound thing is that we are impermanent. 2,600 years ago, the Buddha talked about something that physicists today are just now coming to understand. He talked about kalapas, K-A-L-A-P-A-S. And what he was referring to was these, what he described as infinitesimally small molecules of energy that millions of them blink into existence and out of existence in the blink of an eye. How did he know that? There was no instruments at all. But he could understand it because he had such a profoundly well-concentrated mind that he could see the process occurring. And if we quiet ourselves down enough and develop enough concentration, we might not see kalapas or subatomic, or understand subatomic particles, but we can understand the impermanence of all things with a quiet, well-concentrated mind. And most importantly, we can understand the impermanence of our own self-referential views. And then we get to the point where what Lao Tzu said, once we recognize the impermanence of all things, we'll let go of everything. What will we ultimately let go of? The self-referential views that create confusion, delusion, and suffering. It's what Khandana got during the Buddha's first teaching on the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Sutta on the Four Noble Truths. The Buddha gave this teaching. Khandana said, all impermanent things that arise are subject to cessation. I'm sorry, all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. The Buddha said, you got it. You understand now. You were talking about that. So you're developing the Dhamma very nicely, Lisa. Thank you. Kevin, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good. I'm doing very well right now.
Good.
I had kind of a down enough week. And it's interesting, you know, the teaching is about associations with people, and that a couple of associations that you can't help sometime are your family. You know, you don't choose your family, you don't choose, they're there, you know, so, but I guess you can choose how you relate to your family.
Yeah.
So, but sometimes it can get the better of you.
Mm-hmm.
because there's so much responsibility attached to your family.
Yeah.
And it's all conditioned of like a lifetime's worth, you know, of those associations. So things got to me this week where I, even in the middle of the night, I had one of those dark night of the soul kind of nights. And I haven't had that in a long time. Since I really started meditating, like 6 months, it seemed like that all vanished. But this week, it came back, just one night. And then I got up and I meditated, and meditated again, again, and again. And it was able to be lifted again. So, you know, and it's, I'm sure, the subject of this sutta where you can have doubts, or even if it's not sensual thoughts or angry thoughts, it's really that attachment to, and that will come back, I guess. And, you know, we just have to learn the impermanence of it and let it go. So doing that, it felt by the end of the week much better today.
Thank you, Kevin. You're describing a direct experience with impermanence. It lasted for a little while, your disturbed quality of mind, but in the end it proved impermanent as anything else. And you used the refuge of the Dhamma to work yourself through it. That's exactly how it should be. Again, when the Buddha described the First Noble Truth, dukkha occurs. He's reminding us, this stuff happens in life. It's going to be like this. But you don't have to contribute to more of the same by reacting to it. And everything passes. Thank you for sharing that. Diane, good to see you.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to see you. Good to be here. Thank you for your... I did label what it is that you do. I've got to thinking about thanking you for your steadfastness in doing these, you know, creating the Sangha. And I realized, like, I think it was 2 weeks ago, that's a profound love that keeps you doing this.
I would say that's true.
And I appreciate that so much. I appreciated Anthony's thing about the labels, and that was really instrumental for me in really starting to recognize what's an ego thought. And I just, and that is a fantastic tool for me. Mm-hmm. Whenever I'm disturbed, that's what's going on. And somehow, somewhere along the line, and I don't know whether I read it or I start counting. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, mentally, up to 110, and I don't know why 110 is, whether it's a magic number, but maybe my brain can't go any farther than that. But it is such a fantastic tool when I am disturbed to start counting. When I'm even listening to someone else talk, if I count, I'm not thinking about what I'm going to say. I'm just present, and the only thing my mind is doing is listening and counting, because counting is relatively simple to 110 anyway. And this week I encountered something that was like, this is really, you're being too simple, Diane. This is really dumb. You should be thinking profound thoughts, loving thoughts. And the voice went on and on. And I thought, I got to give up this counting. It's just too simple. My brain is empty. And when I thought, oh, my brain is empty. Oh, that's what I wanted to do. And it was like, oh, okay, I'm all right with this. And it's just, it's an ongoing process. Yesterday, I was thinking this morning how much I like hot dogs. And that is so inconsistent with everything else. I'm an organic vegetable fruit eater, but I love hot dogs. And when I come home from work, I have a physical, basically defined, physically labored job. And I come home and I'm exhausted. I do not want to cook anything. And I have a hot, and I buy them so they're in the freezer, and I have a hot dog in it. It's just all I want. That's great. But then, you know, the rest of the day I've eaten vegetables and stuff like that. What this kind of came to me this morning was kind of interesting. What started all this was I took this client of mine grocery shopping last evening, and it was cold and rainy and miserable, and he is 350 pounds, and he rides this little cart around ShopRite, and I got so agitated at the things he bought, all the Edelman things on the, you know, the everything, and he was at the deli buying what the, and I stood away from him, and I was so agitated. I was thinking, what am I doing here? I'm ashamed to be with him. I don't want to have anything to do with this. It was just awful. And I started counting and count. I couldn't remember the numbers. I jumped in a million times to 13, 14, 26, 20, 32. And it was just, I had absolutely no control over my mind at all. And I just kept working at it, though, because this empty mind felt so good. Anyway, long story short, I came home, I got home eventually. So glad to be in the refuge of my own home. And then I read the sutta last night. And that was so comforting to, it just was exactly what I needed. It was telling me that the things that I was going through were normal. I questioned whether to keep this client or not. Right now, this client is, the hours that I work for him are a lot, and it's really not an association I want to keep. But it's enough money to keep me going right now. And I've got this, you know, dilemma of what do I do? Do I change, you know, anyway. So it's, you know, it's an ongoing kind of a thing. But I learn from this guy every time I'm with him. And it's painful. 360 pounds. He eats whatever he wants to eat. He thinks whatever he wants to think. He thinks about evil. But it's a wonderful practice to talk about what I learn and right thinking. And it takes courage to practice and to live what I believe with this kind of a person. And I'm not. But the thing that all of my clients reflect to me is, I'm no better than they are. None of us is superior, inferior, and it just. Anyway, an empty mind is a good mind.
Thank you, Diane. You've learned very skillfully the difference between approval and acceptance. You know, and you're applying it to what it seems like a rather challenging human being. You don't have to approve of what he is or what he does, but you accept it. And that's wonderful. It allows you to develop that empty mind. So that which leads to some announcements. Pardon me, Becky?
That was such a simple...
Yeah.
Exactly what
Thank you, Diane. What a great class. Thank you all.
Can I just add one thing?
Please.
When I do the labeling, sometimes it helps to put a visualization on it. So sometimes if the thoughts are not coming that quickly, I'll imagine that labeled thought, the past thought on a magic carpet floating away. And if they're coming rapidly, I sort of imagine a video game like Asteroids, and I'm shooting them out of the sky. It does help to couple the visualization with it.
That's golf great. Shots, all those golf shots.
And to Kevin's point, I'll just say the famous Greek philosopher Epictetus said, I think around the time of the Buddha, it's not your thoughts that cause you pain, it's the importance you place on them.
Yeah, the attachments to them. Thank you. That's great. Lisa.
John, there are a lot of statues of Buddha, mm-hmm. and some of them are, he's quite generously proportioned, like Happy Buddha.
Yep.
And so, are there any, did anyone ever, like, was there any art, anyone draw pictures of him, or do we know what he actually looked like?
There was drawing, and there was actually writing during the time of the Buddha, even though it wasn't the Buddha's words weren't written down until much later. But I don't know that there's any drawing that can be definitively said this was a picture of the Buddha. But there was the picture of the Buddha as this fat, jolly soul. That relates to the Chinese influence that. Heavy people was being a heavy person was a sign of wisdom, and also you'll see pictures with the Buddha with these very long earlobes. Yeah. That was another. The significance of that was also wisdom, but it's very, very likely that the Buddha was very thin. He ate one meal a day, and it was a begged meal, so he certainly wasn't getting fat on the locals. Those are just symbolic. Again, it's very likely that he was very thin.
And then, so the one where he's sitting in, one hand in his lap and the other one touching the ground, so that, too, is more of later on depicted vision of him and not...
But
he would have been meditating in that pose.
It does describe what the Buddha said when he awakened. There's some significance to the left hand upturned, I can't remember what it is. But what he was saying, the pose, it's not that one, is he's sitting like this, his right hand touching the ground. And what he's symbolizing is that he has overcome the world, meaning that he has disentangled himself from the world. And those were his words. There were blah, 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 I have overcome the world. For me, there will be no future rebirths. Very significant. And what he's saying is about a future physical rebirth, but it's also he will no longer give birth to another ignorant moment. I have overcome the world. That's the significance of it. And there are, there's a lot of pictures and statues of him like that sitting on the throne. But again, most of them are.
It was not a copy of a former picture, of a former drawing or anything. In other words,
probably
so
not.
Okay.
Yeah, and the most well-known Buddhist art is probably Tibetan, which came hundreds and hundreds of years after the Buddha's death. And they all are very, very intricate. We'll go to Tibet House in New York, and you can see some great Tibetan art. It's really magnificent. All of it very, very symbolic and very, very intricate, and most of it has nothing to do with what the Buddha actually taught. But, it's interesting.
So there's no drawings of him while he was actually alive?
I don't think so. I don't think there's nothing I've ever come across that said definitively this was drawn by so and so during the Buddha's life.
There were descriptions of it, and there's this whole thing about bump on his head. Like if you see your statue there has a bump, and I always thought, oh, that's hair or something. But apparently there was a physical protrusion on
his
head.
There was some
passed down.
Yeah,
and then it's in artwork. It's passed down.
Yeah. Again, it's something symbolic, but we don't necessarily know if it was true.
Yeah.
This one has kind of his long earlobes if you look at it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not likely that the Buddha had these big long earlobes. But that's a sign of wisdom, so he's often depicted that way. What we know is that a human being, Siddhartha Gautama, set out to seek understanding of the nature of suffering and if there was a way to bring individual contributions to suffering to an end. And we know that a human being actually did that, and he left his teachings. And when you understand that, how that was, how the Pali Canon came to be and how it was preserved, it's a remarkable story. And we can also, when you understand the story, you can place authority on the authenticity of those teachings. You know, but beyond that, we really don't know what he looked like. From northern India,
it is said that he was an attractive man, and that when he appeared,
people
did react to his presence.
Yeah, it said that he was a very, very attractive young man and older man. You know, but we don't know a lot. But he certainly wasn't heavy. You know, he couldn't have been because he didn't eat a lot. You know, and he walked constantly. They're always walking into town for their one bowl of food. And they all wandered all around northern India and southern Nepal during their lifetimes to teach the Dhamma. You know, so they were always on the move. They weren't just sitting under trees day after day, eating and meditating. Mm-hmm. Very active.
And so that was in northern India near Tibet,
near southern Nepal. Yeah, it's interesting that even though obviously Tibet was on the border there nearby, the Buddhist teachings, or I really should say Buddhism, because it really wasn't the Buddhist teaching by that time, didn't get into Tibet until probably about 800 years later.
Really?
Because of the route that it took. It first went south through southern India into Sri Lanka and those parts of Southeast Asia, and almost concurrently into Japan, and then from Japan into China, and then from China into Japan and Korea, and then back up into Tibet well after that. So Tibet had the influences that had already taken place as it passed through China and Japan and Korea, and then further influenced by the shamanic practices that were already part of the Tibetan culture. And that's, you can see that strong influence. So, all right, any other questions or comments? A few quick announcements. This week, I'll be starting teaching Thursday night here. And the three classes this week will all be on emptiness. I'll be publishing an article probably today or tomorrow on emptiness. It's about an 8,000-word article. It's like a small book. But I cite three suttas that the Buddha talks about emptiness as he refers to emptiness. And so the classes will be on each sutta this week. Leading up to our retreat on Sunday, which the retreat is on emptiness, our one-day retreat, on Sunday, April 9th. And it's also the theme of our residential retreat, where we'll spend 4 days getting into the Buddha's first three discourses, his most important teachings, and spending time integrating emptiness and dependent origination into our retreat. So I'm really looking forward to that. And I hope you can join us. Last year's retreat was wonderful, and this one's going to be great, too. So, info on all that on the website. I think that's it. Let's finish with metta. Find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talks today. And metta is both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an ongoing expression of a fully awake and fully mature human being. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction, and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.